Welcome to Pediagogy. I'm Tammy.
And I'm Lydia.
And we're UC Davis Children's Hospital trained pediatricians in Sacramento.
This podcast reviews common conditions in children to enhance our knowledge and the knowledge of other residents, medical students, and any other interested learners.
With that, let's delve right into this episode. You're in the NICU taking care of a newborn baby with microcephaly, hepatosplenomegaly, and a blueberry muffin rash. What do you think it is?
So I know we're doing this torch series infection, but this sounds very much like pretty much every torch infection that I know.
Yeah. So let me give you a hint. It's not a virus and it's not a bacteria.
I guess I never really thought about it that way, but I guess toxoplasmosis is the only parasitic torch infection.
Yep. And did you know that toxo was found to be the second leading cause of death and the fourth leading cause of hospitalizations attributable to foodborne illnesses? Because I definitely did not.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I definitely did not either. So learning
something
new
today. Yeah, I didn't realize it was just like so common. So based on the New England newborn screening, where every newborn is screened for congenital toxoplasmosis, which is actually different from every other, like not all states will screen for this, but the incidence of congenital toxo was 0.91 per 10,000 live births from 1988 to 1999. It has gone down to 0.23 for every 10,000 cases from 2006 to 2014, which is good though. Notably, though, like you have to critically think about it. The true incidence may actually be higher for toxoplasmosis because the test sensitivity is only 50 to 75%, and it doesn't account for in utero fetal loss due to the parasite.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And I feel like a lot of us associate cats with toxoplasmosis because they're definitely a host, and that's sort of like a boards or step buzzword, but owning a cat actually isn't really correlated with the prevalence of infection. And in fact, humans are also incidental hosts. Usually we get infected by ingesting the oocytes in contaminated food, water, soil, or ingested tissue cysts in infected undercooked meat like pork, lamb, goat, wild game meats, but also raw oysters, clams, or mussels.
Ugh. Way to ruin seafood for me.
Yeah, sorry about that. Rarely you can also get toxo through organ transplants or blood transfusions, but again, that's like super rare given how much testing we do nowadays.
So pregnant people can pass toxoplasmosis to their fetus through three ways. The first way is a first-time infection in an immunocompetent person during pregnancy or 3 months prior to conception. The second way is reactivation of toxoplasmosis in a previously infected pregnant person who was severely immunocompromised during their pregnancy. The third way is reinfection of a previously infected pregnant person with a new, more virulent or virulent strain. Often after this can happen after international travel or after eating undercooked meat from areas where more virulent atypical strains predominate.
Oh, yikes. Okay. Remind me not to travel when I'm pregnant.
Yeah.
So maternal to fetus transmission rate is less than 5% after acute primary maternal infection very early in pregnancy, but the rate is much higher with acute maternal infections acquired later in pregnancy, varying anywhere between 15 to 70% between 13 to 37 weeks of gestation. So kind of a wide range. Likely transmission rate is higher if mom is untreated or immunocompromised, or if the toxo strain is much more virulent, or it's a primary infection compared to reactivation in pregnancy. But it is important to remember that the severity of infection is higher in the fetus if it's acquired earlier during the pregnancy.
Yeah, I feel like most of the torch infections are worse off if you get it infected earlier in your pregnancy.
Yeah, totally.
So how do we prevent babies from getting toxo from mom? You might think, well, just treat mom, cure her, duh, right? But actually, there's variable evidence on antepartum treatment to decrease the risk of maternal fetal transmission of toxoplasmosis. Hence, it's important to decrease the chances of actually acquiring toxo altogether.
Yeah, so let's talk about all the symptoms that we see in congenital toxoplasmosis. So this includes things like eye abnormalities, most importantly chorioretinitis, but can also include amblyopia, cataracts, nystagmus, and visual impairment. You can get CNS abnormalities, so that includes intracranial calcifications, hydrocephalus, hypotonia, developmental delays, micro or macrocephaly. CNS palsies, seizures, or spasticity. Usually when you check the CSF, you'll see pleocytosis with elevated protein and eosinophilia. Other things that you can see, which are generally pretty nonspecific, but you can see with a lot of other things, include anemia, hepatitis with hepatic calcifications, hepatosplenomegaly, myocarditis, that blueberry muffin rash that we always talk about, sepsis-like illness, and thrombocytopenia.
On your exam, don't get the scattered intracranial lesions of toxo confused with CMV, which causes periventricular intracranial lesions.
Yeah, we try to remember it by like the C in CMV, standing for calcifications that circumvent the ventricles.
Yep, I definitely love that one. The gold standard for diagnosing congenital toxoplasmosis is persistence of positive toxoplasma IgG antibodies after 12 months of age. However, diagnosis can also be made if there are any of the following three findings. So one of those is positive toxoplasma IgG and IgM, and then you can plus or minus have the IgA. The second finding could be positive toxoplasma PCR results from amniotic fluid, peripheral blood, CSF, urine, or any other body fluid. And then the third finding that you could have that would make the diagnosis would be positive neonatal toxoplasma IgG antibodies, but negative IgM and IgA, plus serologic evidence of acute maternal toxo infection during pregnancy, plus evidence of clinical manifestations. These tests can be done in many commercial labs, especially the IgM and IgG, but you can get false positives. So confirmatory testing is sent often to reference labs, especially in pregnant people and neonates when they're paired with sample testing for serology.
So once you've diagnosed congenital toxoplasmosis, you want to get a really good opto exam, preferably by a retinal specialist, and a hearing exam by brainstem auditory evoked response to look for those manifestations of toxo. You should also get a head imaging with a head ultrasound or CT, as well as an abdominal ultrasound.
Do you remember Sketchy Micro and how we treat toxo?
Vaguely. Although, to be honest, Sketchy was sort of after my time, but I think I remember something about sulfur eggs for sulfa drug. I think that was like Bactrim.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't mean to date you, but treatment is 12 months of a combo of pyrimethamine, which is an antiparasitic. I didn't actually know that. Sulfadiazine and folinic acid. And another thing I learned is that folinic acid is actually a natural folate versus folic acid, which I feel like you hear more commonly is a synthetic folate. So those are three treatments. If a baby has severe chorioretinitis or high CSF concentration of toxoplasmosis, sometimes people will give steroids after 72 hours of treatment. In addition, it's important to remember that ophthalmology exam has to be done every 3 to 6 months for the first 3 years of diagnosis, even if the initial exam was totally normal. And then after all that, you still want to do close neurodevelopmental follow-up to make sure that everything is okay.
Okay, so how do we counsel pregnant women to prevent congenital toxoplasmosis, or in general, how do we prevent people from getting it in the first place?
Yeah, so we talked about cats being the definitive host, so avoiding changing cat litter or gardening in soil that can be contaminated with cat feces while pregnant is generally recommended. Having a non-pregnant person change your cat's litter every day also helps, because toxoplasma doesn't become infectious until 1 to 5 days after it is shed in the cat feces. Keeping cats indoors and then also feeding them cat food, which is like canned instead of undercooked meat, can also limit the chances that the cat will be infected.
When it comes to food, you can inactivate toxoplasma cysts by freezing the meat or cooking the meat to a certain temperature. So specifically, they recommend freezing meat below 4 degrees Fahrenheit for at least 48 hours and cooking to at least 165 degrees Fahrenheit for poultry, both whole or ground. Or for other meats, 145 degrees Fahrenheit for whole cut meat, or 160 degrees Fahrenheit for ground meat. Microwave cooking alone is not effective, and there is a heterogeneous temperature in the food that's not effective in killing cysts. Meat that is smoked, cured in brine, or dried can also still be infectious. Raw seafood and unpasteurized goat milk should definitely be avoided. It's also noteworthy that not just eating, but even in using the kitchen utensils or chopping boards that have been in contact with those contaminated meats, touching the mouth after in contact with contaminated meat, or after gardening, eating unwashed fruits and vegetables contaminated with soil are all potential other ways of acquiring this infection, which can be avoided.
So, with all that said, looks like it's that time again to summarize this episode. Congenital toxoplasmosis is a parasitic torch infection that can come from mom having contact with cats or infected foods, usually undercooked meats or raw seafood, which then this transplacentally infects the baby and can lead to chorioretinitis, scattered intracranial lesions, hydrocephalus, and hepatosplenomegaly, among many other things. Diagnosis with serology and treat with pyrimethamine, sulfadiazine, and folinic acid. Another point to emphasize is that in about half of the cases, there may be no obvious risk factors, but toxoplasmosis should not be ruled out if the clinical suspicion is high enough based on symptoms and signs. That's all for this episode. You can find additional information in the podcast description and our social media resources.
Please rate and subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Twitter at PediagogyPod. That's PediaGogyPod.
Special thanks to Orlando Magana at OM Audio Productions for music composition, and Dr. Su Ting Lee and Dr. Lena Vanderlis for mentorship.